Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
Friday, and I am Glenda Geek from Ocala, Florida.
And I'm Coach Jen from Ocala, Florida as well, and you are listening to Horses in the Morning on Horse Radio Network for July 13th, 2012, episode 444. This episode is brought to you by Kentucky Performance Products. Good morning, Horse World.
I can't take it anymore.
Thank God it's Friday.
I would like, if I may, to take you on a strange journey.
We worked all week so that we can eat and own a little piece of God's ground. Pushing papers and pens, red tape never ends. The stress can turn a smile into a frown. I need some horsing around.
Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to Horses in the Morning. It is Friday. It's Freestyle Woo! Friday. Only one more day in the cubicles, if that's what you do. One more drive home, and then you're going to be good for the weekend. And we have a fun weekend planned. Jennifer and I have a lot of activities coming up. I just wanted to mention that Jamie is not here today because she is at her horse show. We'll have some news on that and what's going on with her horse, Jet, and did he make it to the show here in a little bit. But she is not here today. We'll be back on Monday.
All the listeners just hung up. Hey, please.
Yeah, you got. We have a lot of good guests lined up for today, though. We're going to be all over the board today. We're going to be talking Olympics. We're going to be talking about a really neat thoroughbred horse show that's coming up that's getting a lot of interest at a racetrack of all places. And then we're going to be talking about racing silks, where they came from, why they're silk, and you know some of the rules and things that revolve around racing silks. So we have a big show planned for today.
Yeah, and might I add, every equestrian tradition that I am familiar with that came from Europe in the 21st century is completely impractical. And today's conversation is liable to reconfirm that. Silk, really? Could you thought of something more impractical to make riding clothes out of? Silk?
That's true.
We'll be interesting conversation.
That's
right up
saying,
there with
you know,
wool jacket.
I wanted to know why, you know, why wasn't it, you think if it was coming out of England and they would have started in the late 1800s, that it would have been wool, you know? Or, you know, then maybe later on switch to cotton or something like that. But they're shiny, so we'll find out.
Great. It's going to be an interesting conversation. Yeah, I can't wait to talk to her. I'm going to have a lot of questions for poor old Stephanie.
Well, that's all coming up on today's show. And let's get started with the Daily Whinnies. I have two of them today. My first one goes out to Kat from Draper Therapies, and I give her this. It's her birthday yesterday, and I wanted to wish her a happy birthday, and I know she listens to the morning show, so happy birthday, Kat. Not only is Kat a good sponsor of the Horse Radio Network with Draper Therapies, but she's also a friend. She's become a friend since becoming a sponsor, and we've gotten to know her pretty well. So thank you, Kat, and also happy birthday. I have a second Daily Winnie. This goes out to our adopted bug, Callie Francois, who is in New York, rides for Todd Pletcher, and is actually breezes horses for him and is learning the business so that she can become a jockey. They're called bugs when they're jockeys in training. Well, unfortunately, Callie is going to be listening to this episode and her Daily Winnie from the couch because she last week had a bad fall. Apparently, I talked to her on the phone yesterday or the day before, and she took a spill. It was a pretty good one. She was breezing a horse, a mare, I believe, and the mare, the filly, bolted and headed toward the outgate. Apparently, at the track she was riding at, they had two outgates and headed toward one of the outgates. And from what I understand, and I might be getting this all wrong, but Callie was a little drugged up at the time. The horse.
That's not normal for Callie, people.
No, this was painkiller drug. And, you know, Callie's all about 4'10", so you give her half a Vicodin and she's probably under the couch. But anyway, the horse apparently hit the rail or hit something where the stands are or something on the way out the gate and actually flipped over, and Callie flipped over, and Callie's neck, head ended up going under her body. And she did that rotational fall thing herself in addition to the horse. By the way, the horse was fine. The horse was out trotting again the next day. Everything was fine with the horse. But Callie took a nasty spill. She said all she remembers a couple of strides before hitting the wall, and that was it. She doesn't remember anything after that. She was out. They carted her away in the ambulance to the emergency room. They did all kinds of x-rays because they were really afraid. The people who witnessed this said it was bad. And they were really afraid she had broken her neck or, you know, had really done something bad to her back. They were praying that she wouldn't be paralyzed, all that stuff. They did all kinds of CAT scans and head x-rays and everything. And they came back with the only thing, now it's not minor, but in the relative scheme of things, the only thing that she ended up having wrong was she shattered her one ankle, and they had to in three places. So they did send her right to surgery, and they put a whole bunch of plates and pins and screws in her tiny little ankle, and she is now recovering from that. But she actually hit her head really hard, and she hasn't seen her helmet since then. She's trying to get a hold of it, but she says the helmet must have been cracked because she said she hit her head real hard. She'd be dead if it hadn't been for the helmet. She seemed to be in pretty good spirits. Now, that could have been the drugs, but boredom was starting to set in. Jennifer, she said, I'm starting to get bored now. So that was telling me that she was probably feeling a little bit better.
Right. That means the pain pain has gone below maximum threshold when you start to feel bored. Yeah.
Right. She wasn't quite ready to come on the air and make a fool out of herself yet. She wanted to wait till she stopped taking the drugs. So the painkillers. So maybe next week we'll have her on one day. She's a sweetheart. Love her to death.
Yeah. And times like these that you wish you were a chess player.
I know. She's so she's so brave too. She's ready to get back up on a horse. She did say that she's going to be out. Get this. She's going to have the cast on, I guess, for 2 months.
And then
she cannot ride for 5 months. So. She's got a long recuperation time coming up, and they, you know, you think about riding, you think about, especially jockeys in that is that a two-point stance? It's a jockey stance, you know.
It's a toe-hold stance.
Yeah, well, you think about how much pressure that must put on their ankles, and, you know, she's going to have a little bit of time before she gets back in the saddle again, and that's, of course, upsetting her, like it does any horse girl. So we wish her the best. Our best to Callie, and we hope that you get better soon, and we'll hope to talk to her real soon as well. She got some advice from, Rosie DePravnik, the big female jockey there, and she got some advice from Rosie. She talked to Rosie, and Rosie told her, I always look, and Rosie's been hurt a lot, like any jockey, and Rosie told her, every time I get hurt, I look at it as a forced vacation, and I enjoy the heck out of it. Because we don't get much time off as jockeys. So Callie is making an attempt to consider this vacation and enjoy the heck out of it. And but she was getting really bored because she told me she watched Legally Blonde 1 and 2 the other night. And you have to be bored to do that. So. I said, Callie, we need to get you some better entertainment up there in New York. All right, it's time for your team.
My Daily Weenie goes out to the regular co-host of the Horses in the Morning show, Jamie Jennings, for taking on the truly ulcerative task of waiting out her horse Jet's Oscar-winning performance this past week of a horse with a bruised heel, because he was really making the most of it and telling everybody how much he was uncomfortable. And she is now tempting fate in Flagstaff, Arizona, because Jet has gotten the all clear from the veterinarians, and she is going to be competing said ex-racehorse with an attitude with the full knowledge that he has just had a week's stall rest. So good luck, Jamie. And that's not for winning. That's for staying on.
Here, let me read the text I got last night from her. Jet is good to go. Bumped him back to novice since he has had almost 2 weeks off. I just rode him today here at the show for the first time, and dang, he was wild.
That's Jet scary when she says Jet is wild. That's just scary.
I know. Then she added wild but sound, so that was good. But, yeah, so she might have some interesting stories to tell on Monday when she comes back.
I hope she's gotten him this overreach boots.
Yeah, he's going to need some of those, apparently. Well, the United States Equestrian Federation has announced its teams for London 2012, and here we go, dressage. We have Jan Ebeling, by the way, the chat is open. Jennifer wanted me to mention that the Blog Talk chat is open for the show. So if you're a listener who wants to chat with other listeners during the show, go to blogtalkradio.com and just click on the Horses in the Morning link. You can hear the show there in addition to chatting with the other listeners. Dressage for the U.S. Announced by the U.S. Equestrian Federation is official for the Olympics in a couple of weeks. And matter of fact, 2 weeks from today. Is that right? Two weeks from today is the opening ceremony.
It's 2 weeks. I think the 27th, isn't it? The 27th?
Yeah, and dressage starts on the August 2nd. So here we go. The dressage team, we have Jan Ebeling, who we interviewed on the Dressage Radio Show here 2 weeks ago, riding, guess what, Gofalka, which is Ann Romney's horse. So they did make it to the Olympics, and that pair, particular pair, has been to the World Cup 3 times and has some experience under its belt, but it's first time going to the Olympics. So we wish them luck. Of course, there's going to be a lot of eyes in the press on them because of the Ann Romney connection. And, of course, we have Stephen Peters, who's in there. He came in fourth individually in the 2008 Olympics on Revelle, and he is heading back to the Olympics on Revelle, which we're glad to hear. We weren't too sure if that would be the case, but it appears to be. Tina Conyat is also going to be there. And she rode at the USEF National Grand Prix Championships and came in second on Colecto 5, and she'll be also competing Colecto 5 at the Olympics. And then competing as an individual is Adrienne Lyle, riding Wizard. She is trained by Debbie McDonald, and it was also produced, I think, by Debbie McDonald, if I remember correctly. And so she will be riding as an individual. And the eventing side of things, we have Karen O'Connor leading the way, she's the oldest woman on the U.S. Olympic team in any of the sports at 54 years old. She already has a team silver and bronze in the Olympics. She first rode in 1988 in Seoul, and this year makes her fifth Olympics. She'll be competing Mr. Medicott, who was a regular on the German squad before he defected. Don't tell anybody, but Mr. Medicott got in a plane and defected over the U.S. So he'll be riding for the U.S. team this year. Another old-timer, Philip Dutton. He's also competed in 4 previous Olympics, 3 which were actually on the Australian team, and he won winning them team gold in 1996 and 2000. He became an American citizen. He lived here for almost 20 years before he did. And this is his second games for the U.S. team. He'll be riding Mystery Whisperer. And, of course, Boyd Martin, can't forget Boyd, on Otis Barber Terry. And he is, what was I going to say? Totally lost my train of thought, Jennifer.
Where were you at? Because I was busy taking a caller.
Oh, that's okay. He's riding Otis. And that's the one we expected that he would be riding after the recent performances. And let's see here. Also on the team is Will Coleman. He's riding Twizzle. They came in fifth place in Rolex Kentucky this year. And then we have Tina Caudray and Ringwood Magister, who won team gold in 2008 at the FEI North American Young Rider Championship.
That's Jamie's favorite, yep.
Yep, so that's who's going to be competing in eventing. We have a good, strong team there. Show jumping. Reed Kessler did make it. Of course, she's only 18 years old. She'll be the youngest rider to represent the United States, and she'll be riding Solana. So Solana is her – she won the 2012 USEF selection trials on Solana, and that's the horse that she'll be taking. Along with Reed is also one of the oldest riders, and that's Rich Fellers. Rich will be riding the veteran horse Flexible. He's 16 years old, and he won the FEI World Cup. He's the reigning champion in that on this particular horse. And get this, Rich, the 16-year-old has taken Rich to victory in every class but one they won since the World Cup. So they've been on a roll since then. Yep. And joining Rich and Reed are BZ Madden and McLean Ward, two of the old stalwarts. They also have been on the teams winning two Olympic golds, and they also won the team gold in the 2011 Pan American Games down there in Mexico. So they're on the team as well. McLean will be riding Antares F, and I think BZ is riding Coral Reef once again. So that's who you'll be seeing showing up for the U.S. team starting here in just about 2 weeks. So congratulations to all of them, and we wish them all the best of luck. Well, our first guest is on the line and ready, and I asked her to come on this morning because she hasn't been on the show in a while because she bailed out on us, literally. Good morning, Christy.
Good morning, Glenn. I miss you, too.
By the way, we do miss you. Christy was a regular for everybody that listens to the show on a regular basis, knows that she was our contact and the one that came on every week for thehorse.com. And then she decided to bail out and go do some skydiving thing.
I did. I decided to change jobs, and I went to work as a marketing communications director for Skydive Spaceland here in Houston, Texas.
Are you on a speakerphone, Christy?
Am I on a speakerphone? No, I am on a cell phone.
Oh, okay. All right. That's fine. It just sounded a little hollow, but that's okay. So, Christy, how's life been since you left the horse world?
Life has been really good. It's a whole different world, but it's another world that I like. I've always liked both worlds. I've been skydiving since 1997 and jumping in this particular drop zone for the last 5 years. I moved out here about a year and a half ago. So,
and that's
I'm
Texas,
spending
right?
a lot of time. Yes. I'm living just south of Houston. So it's hot and it's wet, and we've gotten about 7 inches of rain in the last couple of days, but we needed it, so I'm good with it.
So now, basically you jump out of airplanes for a living now?
More or less. My job is marketing. The business has me in front of a computer a little bit more than it has me jumping out of airplanes, but I still do a lot of that for fun. I'm on three teams this year that will be competing at the United States Parachute Association Nationals in October and November. So doing three different events. It's sort of like our Olympics, only not really much smaller than that. But it is still the biggest skydiving competition in the world, and that's going to be great fun. So I'm looking forward to that. So that does have me jumping quite a bit. And actually, I just got back from Jamie's part of the woods, although I understand she's not on today. My four-way team took 12 people to the wind tunnel in Skydive Arizona in Eloy, and taught them how to fly better in the wind tunnel. We spent about 12 hours in a wind tunnel last weekend. It was great fun.
Wow.
You should try it.
I should try the wind tunnel thing. I think they actually have one here in Florida, don't they?
They have one in Orlando, yes.
I thought so. I have to try that. That does look like fun.
It is. And, now, you know, you don't have to worry about your landings and whatnot. So, you know, a lot of people prefer that. I will say the scenery is not nearly as good.
The floor.
The waltz. That's pretty much it. They could paint, you know, they could paint some blue sky on it. That'd be nice.
Now, is the wind tunnel out there big enough that you can all practice your formations and things?
It is, actually. The one in Orlando is a little bit smaller. It's a 12-foot diameter tunnel. The one in Arizona is a 14-foot. The biggest public wind tunnel in the country is Rayford, North Carolina, and it's a 16-foot tunnel.
So how many can you get in there? Four?
We put four people in for the camp in Arizona in the 14-foot tunnel. We have put six in there and able to fly. I think we got 12 people in the 16-foot tunnel a couple of years ago. We weren't really trying to do much and be able to move around much, just trying to see how many people we could get in there.
Set a world record in a week.
Yeah, right. Well, if people are flying on their head or the heads of their feet, you know, they obviously take up a lot less of the tunnel diameter, so they can get a lot more people in there that way. If you're flying on your belly, you can't get quite as many in there. But
is the wind tunnel actually a really good simulation for you guys? Is it effective?
It really is. And all of the top teams, I mean, since wind tunnels came on the scene several years ago, pretty much you're not training in the tunnel, you're not going to be anywhere near the top, because you can get so much more flight time in a compressed actual time frame. I mean, so if you think of each skydive as equivalent to a little over a minute of free fall, you know, and my team might spend 4 hours training in the wind tunnel in a weekend, you know, you're getting the equivalent of quite a few skydives in a short period of time. You really get to drill stuff for a couple of minutes at a time, go right back into the tunnel 2 minutes later and do the same thing and with a little bit of adjustment and really see how well it works. Of course, it makes a difference if you're in the tunnel with or without, you know, your parachute rig. Of course, that's adding about 20 pounds. So that definitely makes a difference for weight and balance. And that's the best way to train. It's also not something you want to do for 4 hours.
Right.
So
Jennifer's brother was a Green Beret for many, 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 many years. As a matter of fact, he retired as one of the oldest Green Berets, and it's like 45. And he had many, many hundred jumps under his belt, because that's one of the things that they spend a lot of time doing.
Sure.
And he had done, and I wondered if you ever had done this just for fun. He had done the high altitude drops where they, and low altitude openings, what do they call those?
Halo. Yeah.
Yeah. He had done, you know, where they need the oxygen and all that stuff. And you know, it was amazing what he told us. He said, you know, you can jump out in airspace of one country and go horizontally so far into the country you want to land in that you don't have permission to fly over. He said it's amazing how far you can go. And then they open, at about 3,000 feet. So, you know, their flight time is incredible when you start out at 20,000 feet, you know, or whatever. It was interesting.
Sure.
Stories he had to tell.
Absolutely. And I don't have it in front of me right now, but speaking of that, If you add another level to the halo jump and you put somebody in a wingsuit, some people call them Birdman suits. That's actually one of the
mm-hmm.
brands, but it comes out the same. I'm going to grab my latest issue of Parachutes Magazine, because I remember seeing something about a guy just breaking the horizontal distance record with a wingsuit. And I want to say, I don't remember how high he got out. That's why I want to find it. But I want to say he went something along the order of 20-some miles horizontally.
Wow.
So, yeah, right?
So you can get some distance.
Well, and I'm sure you saw you might have seen on Facebook, or maybe that was just those of us who were in skydiving, but there was a guy about a month ago who actually landed a wingsuit rather than a parachute. He never deployed a parachute. He landed himself, and why he picked cardboard boxes as something soft to land on, I couldn't really begin to tell you, but apparently it worked. Basically made a big runway of cardboard boxes and landed the wingsuit in the cardboard boxes.
Now, have you ever done the wingsuit?
I have done the wingsuit, and it was extremely tiring. There's a lot of leverage on your arms, but once you get used to it, I just like anything else, and it is very cool. It is very cool. It's you fall much, much, much slower. You get a much longer free fall. Okay, I found it. So this guy, Jonathan Florio, just set four new wingsuit records. Greatest horizontal distance flown in a wingsuit, 16.3 statute miles. Previous record was 14 miles. Longest duration wingsuit flight, it was 9 minutes and 6 seconds before deploying its parachute. greatest absolute distance traveled while in free fall, so horizontal and vertical, is your actual diagonal track, 17 and a half miles. And he jumped from the highest altitude, which was 37,265 feet.
Oh, my gosh. He needed a lot of oxygen at that height.
Well, and especially because he's falling slower, right? He's spending more time above 15,000 feet, which is the point above which you're supposed to have oxygen in the plane before you get out. And I think it's above 20,000 feet that you're supposed to take a bailout bottle with you.
Incredible stuff. Well, you know, I know that, you know, you talk about farriers and how their back give out after a period of time. One of the reasons that that Jennifer's brother finally gave up the green braiding thing, other than he was just getting plain tired, was his knees were giving out from all the jumps he had done. Is that a common thing or is that a military thing?
Now, tell me about what time frame this person was jumping in. Do you have any idea which decade?
Yeah, it was
up
until about 2004 or 5, I think he retired.
Okay, I'm not trying to be a pain. I'm really not. But when you're jumping round parachutes, and the military now does not use round parachutes, I'm not sure exactly when they transitioned, but round parachutes don't land softly.
Right.
They just don't. And if I had put in, you know, my 3,300 jumps under round parachutes, I probably wouldn't have 3,300 jumps. But, you know, these days we have square or elliptical or semi-elliptical parachutes that fly just like some of the gliders that you see. You know, that we can control the direction. It's just like a little wing. We can slow them down a little bit for landing so that your landing is basically like stepping off the curb or just, you know, with a little bit of a horizontal slide. And, you know, you can really take the vertical component almost completely out of the landing. So, you know, I mean, I've jumped in. Spend a lot of time jumping in pieces when it's really wet out here. I mean, it's not something that you have to have, like, big combat boots on to keep from breaking your ankles and really damaging your knees. So, yay for technology. Because I wouldn't want to put in that many jumps under a round parachute. And especially with military applications where they're not only jumping around parachute, but they're also probably carrying a 30 to 50-pound rucksack. You know, you add all that.
Right.
That's a whole lot of stress on the body.
Weapons, all that stuff. Yeah,
all that important stuff.
Yeah. Well, this is. Have you done anything with horses since you left?
I sad to say, I have not.
You know, the thrill of riding a horse when you're jumping out of an airplane every day is probably not as great.
Well, you know, since I moved down here, I've pretty much just been involved locally in skydiving, and I don't have a horse anymore, so it's just kind of the world that I've stepped into here.
Christy, if you're having trouble, you need to get something some horses in your life, and you need something that's a genuine thrill because, you know, you jump out of airplanes, all you need to do is go down to the local off-the-track thoroughbred adoption center and help them retrain horses. It'll be
there
a big
you go.
There you go. Very true.
And bring your parachute.
And bring the parachute.
Well, I'd be deploying way too low. I don't think that would actually help. Having worked with somebody off-track thoroughbred, you know, I can see where you're coming from. Although I will tell you one rare exception. A good friend of mine had an off-track thoroughbred at home. She was a wonderful horse. We figured out very quickly. She moved straight. I mean, she had some of the strangest legs you'll ever see on a horse, let alone a thoroughbred. And, you know, she had big old rangy mare. You know, she wasn't going to win any halter classes. You know, she's big, kind of a heavy bone kind of for a thoroughbred, but really nice mare. We figured out why she was off the track, though, when we took her out to the beach and put her out on a group of other horses, you know, cantering down the beach. So you figure this is a racetrack. I mean, high tide, you know, low tide beach, nice packed sand. It's perfect, right? But she canters up to the front of the group, and then she breaks down to trot and literally starts swinging her head side to side. She was terrified to be first.
I've had racehorses like that.
They make great jumpers.
They do.
I think where Christy lives now, though, you're not going to need to worry about that. You're just going to need you're going to need cowboy boots, a big Western belt, and a hat. You'll be all good to go.
Well, and you know, this week I don't even need a horse. I need an arc. So.
Well, thank you, Christy. We appreciate you being on and getting us up to date. We miss you.
Well, I miss you guys, too. I always really enjoy talking to you guys every week, so maybe I'll have to call in on occasion and just keep you guys on your toes.
Yeah, do that. We appreciate it. Thanks, Christy.
All right. Take care.
Be safe. Well, we are going to have our next guest here shortly, but first we're going to hear from our title sponsor today, and that's Kentucky Performance Products. We'll be right back to talk to Stacy Clark Rogers about Thoroughbreds and the Totally Thoroughbred Horse Show at Pimlico Racehorse, a race course coming up. Regular listeners to the show know that we love Kentucky Performance Products. And that's an easy thing to do because Kentucky Performance Products stand behind their products and they believe in them. Your complete satisfaction is guaranteed. If you are unsatisfied with any of their products, they will gladly refund your money. Does your horse or pony get fat on air alone? Is he living in a dry lot or turned out with a muzzle? Can't feed him more than a handful of grain and some hay? Then you need Microphase. Microphase is a great way to ensure your horse or pony gets all of the nutrients he needs to stay healthy without adding calories to his diet. Microphase contains the vitamins and trace minerals not found in grass or hay, and your horse will eat it right out of your hand. You can learn more about Microphase and all of the products from Kentucky Performance Products by visiting kppusa.com. That's kppusa.com. Check out Microphase. Well, thank you to Kentucky Performance Products for their continuing support of Horses in the Morning. It's kppusa.com. Well, our next guest is going to be here in a minute, but before we get to her, I wanted to add a little bit of a news story here about Doug O'Neill, the trainer of I'll Have Another. If you remember correctly, during the Triple Crown, Doug O'Neill was in the process of being suspended in California for 45 days for some drug violations, and he swore that he didn't do it, and he was also going to appeal that suspension. Well, he has dropped his appeal to the suspension. It was reduced to 40 days by the California Horse Racing Board, and his punishment runs until September the 27th and begins on August the 19th, so he'll be out of racing for a bit. He said, I just felt my time and money could be better spent doing more positive stuff. And I think he had fought this for a long time and spent a lot of money on lawyers and things. And I think he just said, oh, heck, I'll take the penalty and get on with life.
You know what it was? He got a good deal on a cruise.
Yeah, something. Because he says he has no specific plans, but he hopes to learn some new things. So maybe relaxation on a beach will be one of those things he learned. Skydiving. We could tell him where to go to learn skydiving. Yeah. Yeah.
Now on that same topic, did you see the article that I think it was the New York Times had about O'Neill and I'll Have Another?
No, huh?
No. Well, part of the agreement that they came to is he is required to provide complete veterinary care records for horses at I don't know if it's just at the track in New York or if all of them or something like that, but the long and short of it is I'll Have Another's treatment records had to be made available to the governing body because they wanted to keep an eye on things. And they are a matter of public record at this time. And some reporter at the New York Times got a hold of it and just wrote a scathing article about, and he intimated that, oh my goodness, you know, that's all these terrible things they're doing with I'll Have Another. He was obviously harboring some kind of a lameness issue that was just ready to end his career. And I think I saw the report on thehorse.com. So I went ahead and clicked the button, looked at the records. And it was funny because you could tell somebody who is not in any way, shape, or form familiar with a competitive level horse wrote the article because I read through it and went, wow, they're really doing a great job of supporting this horse's long-term health.
That's why people who don't know about horses shouldn't write about horses.
Well,
that's
why and at the race, when the horses are stabled at the racetrack, a racetrack vet has to do everything. If you give him 2 Butte in the morning, the racetrack vet has to do it. So the horse is getting a lot of supportive care for obvious reasons. He's a racehorse. He works very hard. And he got some Butte, and he got blood work done, and they gave him some medications to fix because the blood work was a little bit off, and, you know, he needed some help with his red blood cell count or some such, and he got some polyglycan or Adequan, that kind of thing. And it was just so interesting to read the article, which really appeared to be an op-ed piece trying to further flame the either the trainers specifically or racehorse trainers in general. So I thought, well, you know, that was kind of a low punch.
I agree. Yeah, again, as I said, if you don't know about horses, you shouldn't write about them because you're out of your league. And speaking of which, talking about thoroughbreds, we have HRTV has provided us today with Stacy Clark Rogers, who's going to tell us about something fun that's coming up at Pimlico Racecourse on July the 14th, which is tomorrow. And admission is free, and it is, I think it's a little bit of an experiment that is working very well so far. So let's say good morning to Stacy.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Good. So I read, 500 entries you guys are having to get extra judges in?
Oh, we've had to get an extra ring belt. Yeah, we've got, you know, Georgia Ann Hale and Pimlico and the Maryland people here have been amazing. I mean, this is something Georgia Ann's been talking about for a year or so and probably more longer in her own mind. But it's been an amazing program. They've certainly pulled everybody out of the woodwork to get this job done. Tons of volunteers, lots of crew here helping out. And it looks great. It's in the infield of Pimlico Racetrack, Old Hilltop. And they have three beautiful rinks set up. They've got room for concession stands, and they've got the barn set up, a few barns in the backstretch ready, parking's organized. I don't think anyone anticipated this much. You know, when it's a new thing, and this is a very new thing, there's never had a horse show at a racetrack before for thoroughbreds only. And show up, you don't. Smart and that she looked the area and she picked this weekend because it was kind of a quiet weekend for horseshoes. But I don't think anyone anticipated 500 entries thus far. I mean, we still have entries up until tomorrow. Like, we're still going to take them as people come in. So that's great.
Now, Stacy, tell us about the show. It's called the Totally Thoroughbred Horse Show, and it's only for thoroughbreds. But what kind of classes, what are you going to be doing?
There's lead line classes for little kids, 6 and under, 12 and under. There are walk, trot, canter. There is jumping 1 foot, 2 foot, 3 foot. You know, it's a little bit of everything. It's nothing too big. It's nothing overwhelming. For it being the first show, hopefully we'll have more. This is sort of just trying to figure out what, you know, who our participants are going to be, how is it going to run. You don't want to go out and say you're going to go gangbusters and have this big overwhelming thing and not be able to control it, but it's actually, you know, taking a life of its own, as things that are successful do. And it's overwhelming, and it's really inspirational. I think it's something that's a tribute to the thoroughbred to find that 500 of them are going to be showing tomorrow, and this is a good thing for everyone. Really great.
So it's essentially for those of us outside of the All Thoroughbred Show. It's basically a hunter show, yes?
Yep, it's basically a hunter show, and it goes by hunter rules. It's a fun show. It's not, you know, it's a little bit more than a fair show, and it's not, you know, we're not going in the trillium area or the professional area. This is a show where people can have a good time. They can, you know, showcase their thoroughbreds. These are off-track thoroughbreds that have tattoos, and you know, some of them are really interesting. They have great past performances. We have horses that are 22 years old, and we're racehorses.
Oh, wow.
We have horses that are 4 years old. Actually, there's one horse that's 22. But, I mean, it's a real cross-section of horses that are with little kids. I met a few girls yesterday from a riding club. They're bringing 11 horses. They're all thoroughbreds. They're, like, you know, all dressed in pink, and their little britches, and they're so excited, and you're just like, wow, this is why you came. Like, this is to be here tomorrow to see the horses doing their second job, delighting little girls and little boys, and having a great time. You know, this just shows you that thoroughbred is not this big, scary, hot horse that can only be a racehorse.
You know, we've owned
a bunch
of... I love
that you guys...
Go ahead, Jennifer.
Go ahead, Glenn. I love that you guys require the horses to be showing under their jockey club names, because so many times, probably the vast majority of the times, when thoroughbreds move into their second careers, their path is it's gone. Nobody, if they're even interested in it, it's gone. And I love that you're asking people to maintain that and to honor that. Well, and it's kind of hard because sometimes they give them really stupid names, but to allow that to move forward and to have a little pride in the horse's heritage, so to speak. And I think that's really cool. But on the other hand, what do you do with the name? What do you do with the names that are like a little off color?
Oh, well, you know, for the most part, there aren't any names that are a little off color. You know, I think the Jockey Club has really clamped down on that in the last 10 years. We don't have too many unmentionable racing names. And, I mean, it's the good thing about it, and I think the really important thing is that it's bringing everything full circle, not just for the horse people that have these horses and are giving them new homes. It's sort of, it connects the dots between the two industries. The racing industry has a disconnect between the show industry, and we want to make that awareness that, you know, there is something for the horsemen to do with their horses after racing. It doesn't have to be, you know, oh, well, I'm going to give them to this guy, I might give them to that guy. You know, we make these contacts, we show people what can be done. That's inspirational. Most horse people at the racetrack want to have their horses have a better life afterwards. And by bringing this to them, showing them what can be done with them, then maybe they'll make the right contacts, we'll make the right networking for the industry itself. And then when you look back as a racetrack owner and you look back at your horses, and we do this at Adena, we have all our horses come through the program that are retired, and we'll say to everyone, like, how's it going? Can you send us some pictures? And if you look on our Adena website, we've got a whole chapter of success stories where these people send the pictures with their adopted thoroughbred at their prom, at their wedding. You know, this is him in the show ring. So, you know, oh, look at Golden Mustang. He's gone to the prom with his 18-year-old owner, LJ. And so it's kind of a nice way to see it carry on for everyone, that this racing is just a stage in some of these horses' lives. And then if they can't be a stallion or not going to be a broodmare, then they can have a second career. And you can hold your head high in racing for this reason, because we're taking care of our horses.
Well, we've owned a bunch of off-the-track thoroughbreds over the years, and my co-host, who's normally here today, is out showing one right now, as a matter of fact, on the West Coast. But one of the things that these off-the-track thoroughbreds haven't seen in a long time, most of them, is a racetrack. Are we expecting some of them to get a little excited when they show up for the first time back at a racetrack?
Well, maybe they will. I mean, the one thing you're not going to work. We're doing it from the backstretch. The horses are coming in from the backstretch. There's going to be vans parked all on the track. It's not going to look like a big wide open stretch when they walk across the track into the infield. The infield has three rinks set up. There's tents there. It looks like a showground. It doesn't look like the awe-inspiring when the thoroughbred walks on the track and takes a look down the left and goes, oh, wow, there's the half-mile pole. This is a totally different visual for them. And I think, you know, they're down. They're not as high up there as fitness. When you take a horse off the track, they're going to be, not to say that I don't think there's going to be the odd horse that said, wow, I've been here. And, you know, and it might have a little bit of, you know, time to take it to settle down. But I think the ladies I met yesterday that are bringing these kids on those horses that they've had in their training barn for so long, you know, they're putting them in trailers and taking them to here on Saturday and then the next Saturday here. These horses are living a different lifestyle now, and I don't suspect that we'll have too many of them, you know, be too silly. I can't see that happening. The difference, too, is, you know, and then you guys were talking about drugs and what's happening in racing earlier on the show. We're not allowed to have any more medication in horses that will hop them up, like Aquapoise or Winstrol or any of these things. So the geldings that we're getting off the track don't have any of that in them anymore. And so they're making the transition into a quiet riding show horse a lot easier than they were, say, 15 years ago.
Yeah, and that is true. And, you know, we were adopting those horses 15 years ago, and you always had that come down time.
Yeah,
which you don't have that much of anymore. It makes it less of a crapshoot when you're taking a look at the horse in the first place than what you're going to end up with 3 weeks from now, you know. So that is very true.
Yeah.
What's the HRTV connection? Are they going to be filming this or doing some coverage of it?
HRTV is doing, they're packaging a show together. Carolyn Connolly is coming in. She's going to ride, actually, in the show herself and do some broadcasting. We're just sort of trying to get some coverage. HRTV, as you know, does all kinds of different horse events, not just racing. They cover some Western events and some show events. And we just thought that it would be great for both of us, for them for some programming, and us to get some coverage and some exposure for what we're doing across the nation. To show what's happening. And I think that's from my point of view, the most important thing right now is getting it out there, getting it out on Facebook, getting it out on the websites. And because if people are going to look for a horse and they can see that a thoroughbred can do all these things now and always could, then maybe we won't be competing so much with the warm blood in the show ring. Maybe we can, you know, see the pendulum swing back the other way as it was in the 70s, right?
Well, that's terrific. It's at the Pimlico Racetrack. And by the way, to relieve everybody's fears, no, there is not a race meet going on right now at Pimlico. So the horses will not be running around the outside while they're showing on the inside. This is July the 14th. It starts at 10 o'clock. And as I understand, it's free, right?
It's free. And actually, we're going to have people warming up at 8 o'clock. So there will be, you know, people will be here early in the morning. There's going to be a lot going on. And, it's a free venue. Just, you know, come enjoy yourself if you can. Take some pictures. Tell your friends about it. I expect that there'll be some food stands and there's some bleachers and stuff to watch from. Who doesn't want to miss the little kids? I mean, that for me is going to be the highlight of the day. There's a picture on Facebook, I think, today of four of them sitting. They just got dressed up for the show and somebody sent us in a picture. And, you know, the big, huge helmets that are bigger than their heads and the boots and the little blazers. Like, that's just going to be a card. That'll be hilarious to see. So I'm looking forward to that.
Well, please assure me that Kegasus is going to be stabled and not allowed out of his stables that
Kegasus
day.
In lockdown, absolutely okay. Not coming out. No, that's only for the infield on Preakness Day. He's only allowed to come out of his man cave once a year, and that's only on Preakness Day, and we know what that's like. So, you know, it's nothing like that. It's a totally different infield. There's no drinking or anything in this infield this time. So.
I'm glad to hear that, Stacey.
Yeah, you know,
I wanted to clarify. It's free to get in. It's not free if you're an entrant or you're participating, but it's free to get in and watch.
No.
So,
yeah, and all the donations are going to aftercare. That's really important. Like everything, every entry fee is going to aftercare. We have three big ones that we're supporting, and that's a good thing. So.
Well, this is terrific. It's brought to you by the Maryland Jockey Club and Adena Springs. And we appreciate them putting this on. What a great thing to do on a track. You know, these tracks have their off months and their down times. But, you know, it's a way to get them used during those down times as well for something that supports their industry. It's terrific.
Yeah, thank you very much. Hope you come out, guys.
Thank you, Stacey.
Take a plane.
All right, terrific.
Okay, bye-bye.
The Thoroughbred Racehorse Show, and we'll put a link to it on our Facebook page. And we hope that anybody in the area can stop out and pay a visit to it. And let's hope, you know, with 500 entries, we might see a lot of tracks, Jennifer, around the country all of a sudden wanting to do some horse shows.
Yeah, that's quite, yeah, that is an excellent turnout for those folks. That's really exciting.
Well, we're going to take our break for our song. We have Equestrian Collections Product of the Week, and then we're going to do a little Rigel Band and our listener Shay on the fiddle with one of my favorites called Vivid. So we'll be right back after that to talk about how silks came to be silks. Hi, Glenn the Geek here, and I am back with Debbie from Equestrian Collections with the Equestrian Collections Product of the Week.
I wanted to talk about this week the Cashel Quiet Ride Bug Net. Now, every one of us out there has a fly mask for our horses, but this is a fly mask for people. I'll tell you, when you're trail riding and you're out there and you're in the woods, like after a storm or something, and the mosquitoes or the deer flies come out, this is perfect. I always thought it looked kind of silly. And then I bought one the other day because we had been out and the gnats were horrible. So I went home and bought one, wore it out to the same place like 2 weeks later, and I could not believe it. It really, really works. It keeps the gnats out of your eyes and out of your contacts and out of your nose and the mosquitoes. And it's not really that hot. It's just like you had a fly mask on, and you can trim it. If you have a shorter neck, you can trim it. It goes up under your helmet. You can tuck down in your shirt or outside of it. I was just amazed at how well it did. It was something that I don't think I ever want to be without on those trail rides at those places that are very buggy.
And this year we have a tremendous problem with mosquitoes all over the country, so this is just a perfect item. And it's affordable at $15.95. You can find it easily. Just go search for Quiet Ride Bug Net at equestriancollections.com, and it'll pop up, and you can get one in your hands very soon. Well, that was Shay and the Rigel Band, our listener Shay, and also Horse Girl, and she's 18 years old, and she's the one on the fiddle, and it's hard to believe that she can fiddle that well at such a young age, but it's she's terrific. You're listening to Horses in the Morning. I am here with Coach Jen. Jamie is out today. She is at the show with Jet. Jet got healed up a little bit, and she's trying to show him this weekend, so we'll see how that goes. She did drop him back to novice so that he would he had a couple weeks off there with his injury, so she was going to give a novice a try this weekend. We'll hear all about that on Monday when Jamie will be back. We are brought to you today by Kentucky Performance Products at kppusa.com. Well, the our Horse Radio Network show highlight, I want to talk to you a little bit about the Stable Scoop show we did. was called Inner City Slickers, and we had Michael McNeil on, who was the former Three Dog Night drummer. And Helena and I absolutely love Three Dog Night. Matter of fact, since I told Helena that we were having Michael on, she was singing Three Dog Night songs the whole time before the show. So we had a great time. He started a charity, and they do terrific work. They help inner city kids with horses, but they do it in a fun sort of educational way. He is involved in it himself, and they really bring cowboys to the inner city. That's why they call it Inner City Slickers. It's a fascinating program that you want to hear about. We also had his director on, Cindy Lindeman Corwin, who was on also. And then Jennifer joined us on that show talking. She had done a product review and tested at what's called the Extreme Air shirt from Caspian Casual. It's a long sleeve shirt that you wear in the summertime. It helps keep you cool. And you can hear whether Jennifer liked it or not over on the Stable Scoop Show, episode number 204. That's out now. You can find all of our shows at horseradionetwork.com. Well, before we get to our next guest where we talk about racing silks, I wanted to bring you a little bit of an interview that was done on the Eventing Radio Show this week, and it's with someone that the Horses in the Morning audience should be very familiar with, and that's our friend, Canadian eventer Jessica Phoenix. She had hurt herself and broke her collarbone at Bromont just six, 7 weeks ago. And now she's still riding in the Olympics. And Samantha had a chance to catch up with her and talk to her about what that's like and how she's healing. And, you know, Jessie has been a favorite of ours here at the Horse Radio Network for many years. We followed her in the lead up to the World Equestrian Games. She was our spotlight eventer. And she's just a terrific, bubbly person. And this is a girl, as you listen to this interview, keep in mind she just broke her collarbone a couple of weeks ago, and now she's off to compete at the Olympics. She's a tough cookie.
Jessie, welcome back to the Eventing Radio Show. It's great to catch up with you. First things first, how on earth are you?
I am fantastic. As soon as they did the surgery and put the plate and the screws into my collarbone, I was feeling so much better. It just really stabilized everything, and I felt ready to go.
Of course, you fell off. You and Tucker had a fall exponential at Bromont, not even in the warm up, was it? It was the day before the competition in a training session with David. And I made the mistake with Glenn at the 2010 radio show of saying that you would never come back having your baby. You wouldn't come back in time. So this time I said, listen, if anyone can do it, Jessie can do it. So how long after surgery, how many hours did it take you before you were riding?
You know what? My doctor said to wait 1 week. He said by doing the surgery, if I waited 1 week, it would be as strong as if I had waited 3 weeks without doing the surgery. So I gave it the week, and then Amanda Jones, my groom, and Exponential and I traveled down to Virginia, and David rode Tucker probably for the first 2 days, and I would just pack him down to the ring for him. And then on the third day, I started actually doing some trot and canter.
And David rode him while you were pregnant, is that right? And while you were getting over having Jacob?
You know what? I brought Tucker home with me to Canada while I was having Jacob. So this is really the first time David's ever had some one-on-one time with Tucker.
So what was that like? What was that like for him, and what was it like for you to watch him?
It was amazing. I'm a big believer that everything happens for a reason, and I'm actually really glad that I broke my collarbone so that David could sit on this horse. And I just think that his flat work has improved so much in even the week and a half that we've been down here.
And is it easier now? Obviously, you've had lessons with David since. Does he understand Tucker more having ridden him himself, and does he give you any different advice? Because I know he's helped you, you know, for many years and knows Tucker and you very well.
Yeah, I mean, he's an excellent coach and he knows us inside and out, but I think the biggest advantage of having him actually riding Tucker is that David has such incredible feel on a horse and he is so consistent, and Tucker just seems to... He loves that. I mean, he's the kind of horse that when you're riding him, he likes you to be very close and very quiet. And I think David's just so clear with him that it's really progressed. in a short time, and then with me sitting on and feeling how he feels after David's kind of gotten him to that place, it's just been a really beneficial journey.
And will David ride him anymore?
Well, I think David should keep riding him on the flat. Actually, no one else has ever jumped exponential since I've had him. So I'm the only one that's doing the jumping and the galloping on him, but I think it would be awesome if David could just keep sitting on him at some point throughout every flat ride, just to keep explaining it to him.
Mm. I'm not sure if you'd believe you if you said that you were feeling a bit sore or tired, but you might be able to think of some excuse. Does your collarbone bother you at all anymore?
You know what? When I'm riding, it does not bother me. Sometimes if I've done a little bit too much, just before I go to bed, I'll feel it. And I have to send a huge thank you to Jessica Hamps, who actually gave me her ultrasound bone healing system to use through this little exciting journey. So I'm really thankful for that, and that makes a huge difference. So whenever I do feel the collarbone hurting a little bit, I just put the bone healing system on.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Tucker. He is, of course, an ex-Canadian racehorse that you got from the track when he was completely sour on racing and didn't really want to do anything. And he's just the most phenomenal jumper. Bromont, of course, was the final trial for the Canadians, and you didn't get to compete there. Were you nervous at all? And then what did you have to – did you wait for the phone call? How did that all shake down?
Tucker has an exceptional track record with his jumping. And his dressage is very consistent. It's definitely not the most competitive dressage score, but it's an extremely consistent dressage score. And I think not doing Bromont, I still had a lot of confidence in the horse, and I think Canada did as well.
Yeah. So when did you get the news that you were on the Olympic team?
It was actually the Sunday night of Bromont. So Jen Holling, our Canadian selector, called me. Actually, she texted me and said, hurry up and call me. I have some exciting news for you. And so I gave her a call, and that moment when you get that call and you have the confirmation is just an incredible moment, and it's one of the most exciting phone calls you get in your life.
Yeah. And, of course, you've had it once before, but you didn't quite get to go. So this time we'll keep fingers crossed.
Yes.
You've got your injury out the way. Will your husband, Joel, and your son, Jake, be able to go with you?
Yes, they. Jacob actually came down to Virginia for the first week that I was here, and then Joel actually flew down and then flew Jacob home, and they're coming back again Friday night.
You travel this weekend to England, and you'll be going to Gatcombe next weekend, and then what is it? You're in training camp until the Olympics?
So our training camp will be at Maisie Manor in Marlborough. And that's a place that we've been twice now, when we did Blenheim and then again when we did Burley. And it's a fantastic facility and a really great owner, Catherine. And it's just it's a great place to go and train.
Great. And you'll just do, I presume you'll just do the combine training gap and you won't run the full event.
Yeah, that's something I think we're going to play by ear. Depending on how David's feeling about each horse and rider, we may actually run a little bit of cross-country or all of it or four jumps. I think that's something that we'll definitely play by ear and make a decision on the day.
Great. Well, Jessie, thank you so much for talking to us. I won't keep up any of your time, but I will definitely come and find you at Gatcombe and bug you again there. And I know you're hugely, popular, as is Tucker, and we're glad your heel's right. And have a safe trip over and see you soon.
Thank you so much. Can't wait to see you guys.
Thank you.
Well, that was Jessica Phoenix, the Canadian eventer, on her way to England to compete in the Olympics after breaking her collarbone. And as she said, that's something that I didn't expect to hear, where she said, oh, it's the best thing that ever happened. But then I guess if you have David O'Connor riding your horse while you're down, that's not too shabby, is it, Jennifer?
Not bad at all. Oh, I broke a fingernail. Can you ride my horse?
So good luck to her. We always are rooting for Jessie to do well. She's one tough little cookie. And you can hear the rest of the interviews. They had about a dozen of them, it seems like. As a matter of fact, they called it the United Nations edition. They interviewed riders from four different countries on the Eventing Radio Show, episode number 204 at horseradionetwork.com. We're going to get to our guest in a minute and learn all about racing silks and where they came from and why and what's with all the designs on them and all of that in just a minute. But first, we have to talk to you about passion. And passion is not something you normally equate to your manure fork. But people, I'm telling you, and Jennifer can vouch for this, and Aubrey, who is now listening, I know, our listener there in, I think, Virginia, she has one of these, and you get passionate about your manure fork. When you own an Equity manure fork, it's the only manure fork in the world that has a fan club and people who are passionate about it and don't want other people to touch it. Nobody else in the barn is allowed to use it because this once you try an Equity manure fork, you'll never go back to anything else because they're just built. They have a suspension system built into the fork, which is one of the things that makes them different than other forks, so that when it gets caught on something, it doesn't like throw poop all over your face. I mean, this thing is incredible. It's just built to last. They're sturdy. They're rugged. Your horse can step on them. You can step on them. We've done all of that with ours, and they just last. I mean, it's just a complete difference from the cheapy ones you buy at the local store to these Equity forks. Now, they cost a little bit more, but they're incredible to use, and you won't be replacing them as often as you do the others, and you won't want to because you truly do become passionate about your manure fork. And then
it's
there's
like
those
this.
People. Yeah.
Glenn, kind of like this.
Yeah.
When you were 16, you learned to drive in your father's 1968 Volkswagen Beetle.
Yeah,
and the 1968, the 1968 Volkswagen Beetle was just fine. It got the job done. It got you from point A to B. It was very exciting. You were 16. You got to drive.
But it didn't have
the minute,
and the clutch was stiff as a board.
But the minute you got into a modern vehicle that had all the luxuries of a modern
that
vehicle,
had heat.
You were never that had heat and air conditioning and an automatic transmission. You never wanted to ever, ever, ever sit in and drive a Volkswagen Beetle again, did you?
And I have not since then. That is correct.
See, that's the way the Equity Flex and Fork works. Or if you do a lot of stalls, you can use the Shake and Fork. Once you've tried it, then you realize what you're missing. Because for folks who just, you know, clean six stalls a day, plain old pitchfork, $29.95 from the local feed store, replace it every year, get new color, you don't realize what a piece of crap it is until you use one that isn't.
That's right. And it's called the Flex and Fork, and it's from Equity Manufacturing. You can get the Shake and Fork, which is the motorized version. If you clean a lot of stalls every day, you'll want this because it does half the work for you, and it saves you a bunch of money in bedding, too. So that's equitymfg.com. Check it out today and order one. Use it. You will never go back, and you'll discover why. You think I'm crazy now saying you're passionate about a manure fork. You won't after you try one. Well, Jennifer, why don't you introduce our next guest?
Coming up now, Stephanie from Classics Racing Silks USA with Racing Silks 101. All the questions you've always wanted to ask about racing silks, but were too embarrassed to ask, we're going to answer them today. Welcome, Stephanie.
Well, thank you.
Now, and I apologize in advance for I just pressed a button on my computer and you disappeared. Thanks for the introduction, and give us how did racing silks come about? Let's start from square one here.
Well, the horses have been around forever. They've been a mode of transportation, entertainment, you know, so forth, like way back to the 12th century, even prior to that, you know, there were mules and et cetera. So anyway, it's been traced back to, I think, around the 12th century, and the Crusades, and mostly over in England when the knights came back with Arabian horses. And then about 400 years, they started breeding them and that sort of thing. And anyway, as human nature is, we're competitive, and it became a sport of sorts, but kind of a sanctioned professional sport as early as they've traced it back to about the 1700s or so. And again, it was in England where, although I haven't seen it documented, but I know in Arabia and the Middle East, naturally people would race against each other. It's kind of called a match race when there's just two horses, you know, mine's better than yours and that sort of thing. But in more of an organized sort of sport, it's been about 400 years, and it was in England mostly, and the first racetrack in America was built in New York in 1665. Not quite sure what it looked like, but that's the best I can recollect. So after the Civil War, it was really became organized, and the American Jockey Club is our sort of founding organization to govern the sport, and that was founded in 1894. So, and then there was pari-mutuel betting and all sorts of different things. When the war comes, the different wars, it's slacked off, and in a little bit time of prosperity, it increases. But all in all, it's you know, that's sort of the generics of it. It's been a love of the horse, and people have found different ways to use it.
So the silks. Oh, go ahead, Glenn.
I was just going to say, how did the silks start with silk? Why didn't they start if it was back in England back then? Weren't the jockeys wearing cotton or wool even?
Well, they were.
Okay.
They were wearing, they used whatever they could get. And in the countryside, wool was used. Woolens were used pretty readily. And it was people just wanted to know, where's my horse? And how can you tell them apart from the other horse?
Right, right.
And then the people that had access and more money, you know, silk was a lighter fabric, but really there was only silk and wool. There was natural fibers. There was probably cottons as well. But silk was more for the higher owners, if you would say. But it did start out with wool. You're right.
It was a richer fabric then, and that's why they ended up using them. Now, it's also sort of glossy and can be seen well from a distance.
You know, I think more than anything, you're referring to the actual silk fabric back
yeah.
in the day?
Yeah.
Okay. That could have been, I don't have any documentation of that kind of issue, of that sort of thing. I just think people used what they could get their hands on, and they used what their clothes were made out of, because that's what everybody, all their clothes weren't really at stores. They were dressmakers
right.
and tailors.
Right.
So that's sort of how it started.
Yeah, well, and they weren't using cotton because cotton had to come from North America. So they weren't using cotton. So it made sense. And silk, I suspect, holds a more vibrant color than wool, if I remember my textile education in its infancy. So they called it – there's another name for what the jockeys wear. They're also called – colors, is that right?
Yes, there's two ways to refer to just a quick run over. Silks or colors are what the shirt and the cap. It's a set, the shirt and the cap, or some people call it a jersey. It's referred to as a jacket in England. But the top and the helmet cover, the cap is a helmet cover. It goes over a safety helmet. Those two pieces consist of racing silks or racing colors, and it's just been abbreviated to silks or colors. And I'm sure that the silks part came from way back in England when people were actually using silks. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that would definitely make sense.
Okay, so the next question that we find ourselves asking all the time, those of us who only know enough about racing to watch the Triple Crown,
mm-hmm.
we see the horses parade on their way to the post, and you pick out your favorite horse by his silks because it's easy to spot, and they're all brown horses. Who do the silks technically belong to? So when Zenyatta is wearing her purple and teal silks, they're not Zenyatta's silks. Are they the owners or the trainers, or how does that all work?
Okay, it's real simple. when your horse appears at the track, you're exactly right. The fans recognize it pretty much by the silks. Listen, even the race callers, who their business is racing to know the horses and all, they use the color of the silks. There are saddle towels that are put on, so you know the post position. But basically, the silks, and ironically, what's given the most attention is the back and then the front. But the sleeve, for you and I, you know, when that horse is racing, really what you see is the sleeve, the most.
Right.
So basically, silks are is a uniform.
But
and
does it go by the owner?
It's,
so if
okay,
it's
well,
owned by George, you wear George's silks? Is that how
right.
it goes?
How it goes is silks denote, silks show ownership. It is whoever owns that horse. So if you and Glenn buy a horse and your partner's in a horse, that now becomes your team. You are team Jennifer and Glenn. You are, or whatever your partnership might be called. That is your team, your franchise, and you design your silks. And when those are posted in the program, in the racing form, that's you. That's your, it's kind of your business. It's just like if you've got your Horses in the Morning show. Okay, well, and you may have a logo for that. Well, people in horse racing, owners. Now, you do have trainers that have colors as well because that's their business, and they will race horses. And that brings us to a question you might ask as well. Sometimes, if you don't have silks and you haven't had a chance to get them made, or you claim a horse and it runs back in 2 weeks or something and you don't have silks, then you might run in the trainer's colors, and that's acceptable. You can't do it for very long, but
there's a contingency
that's
for
the
that.
Backup.
Yes, that's the backup plan.
But
I'm starting to get my head around this. So you have the silks belong to the owner, so that's an ownership.
Yes.
Now, a trainer can also be an owner, because I know sometimes when I look in the program,
sure.
the trainer and the owner are listed in there, the same person. In that case, he would be racing under the trainer's silks.
Right,
or
because
colors.
He's the owner.
Mm-hmm. Okay, or if the horse has very recently changed ownership, you might also see the horse racing under the trainer's colors because the new ownership, for whatever reason, doesn't have colors available. Okay, I've got my head around that. Now,
there's a
third
issue as
uh-oh.
Well.
Oh, man, this is really complicated, Stephanie.
No, it's pretty easy. They want you to have fun at the races. They want you to be able to, the thing is, you have to have some kind of silks. That horse, when it's put on, you know, post, drawn for post position 8, it has to have, the jockey has to have some silks. He doesn't show up in his undershirt. He has to have silks. It's a sporting event, and they're identified. So if the owner does not have his own silks, and the trainer is not going to, you're not going to run in the trainer's silks, or let's say you're at a track far away from home. You ship the horse, and the silks don't show up. They have what they call house silks. And they're just, it's like plan Z. They hate to do it, but racing must go on. Instead of scratching the horse because of no uniform or no racing silks, they will use the house silks. So sometimes you might see someone racing in at some tracks they're red with blue sleeves. They're kind of an odd thing. Sometimes they have the track's name on the back. So if you see someone racing in a Belmont Park set of silks, that's why. The racetrack doesn't own the horse. They're just called house silks.
So do the silks travel with the horse? Is that how it goes? That they and because, you know, I've been to Churchill Downs and I've been in the silk room where, you know, there seems to be hundreds of them all lined up in there. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, there are.
Yeah, it's just so cool. Do they travel with the horse? Is that what happens?
Yes. And if you know, when you order your silks, that's one of the questions we get a lot is how many do we need? Well, even if you're a first-time owner and you have one horse, you really probably only need one set to get going. If you want one for framing, then you get two, then you have a fresh one. Sometimes a lot of people do order two sets right off the bat because then they have what they call their backup set. But typically, there's one set of silks that is kept at the main track where the horse runs.
Right, right.
If the horse is shipped, somebody, usually it's a trainer, but their mind could be on other things, are supposed to pick up the silks and take them with the horse. That is how, in a perfect world, that's how it would work. The silks would go with the, not so much with the horse on the van, they would go with the trainer or somebody to the jock's room. Then, of course, they have to be picked up and afterwards and, you know, returned. So if you're going to race, if you're in like a circuit where in the Midwest there's a lot of racetracks that are somewhat closer and also, you know, Maryland to Pennsylvania, all around there, they're close tracks. You might have four or five sets and you just keep them at the different racetracks.
Right. Well, now, I have two quick questions for you before we run out of time. Is if I wanted to have Horse Radio Network with our really cool logo put on silks, could I do that even though I don't race, and how much would that cost?
Everything depends on the work. There's a base price, and then it's the artwork, whatever you come up with. Not just an actual logo, but you would incorporate, you know, we help you design it, so, you know, you've got the sleeves, the front and the back, and everything kind of coordinates, collar, whatnot. So there's two different kinds of fabric now that are used. And, you know, we were talking about silks and woolens originally, but it's really gone to a lightweight nylon. About, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 years ago, D. Wayne Lucas introduced a Lycra, kind of a stretch swimsuit fabric. Mm-hmm. And so that's another way you could go. But using those two silks, they have different pricing. You could probably get a really nice set of silks for any way where between, I'd say, maybe 150 to 300. And,
okay, and now the big question, though, is do they make them an extra large? Because that I can't fit in the little jockey silks. Just saying.
Well, you know, they're all made pretty much one size for thoroughbred racing. The jockeys are either tall and slender or short and stocky.
You should be in politics. What she just said is there's no chance they're going to fit me. That's what she just said.
Exactly. However, we get people and we get TV anchor people around Kentucky Derby time that want to be on air in silk. So we have made, as a matter of fact, he's a race caller now down at Hollywood Park. Oh, God, I can't think of his name. He's really a big guy. He's like I think he might be 6'5", and he's close to 300 pounds. He's a big guy. And for Halloween, we did a wonderful costume for him, a set of silks. So, yeah, you can get it. It's, you know, those are all custom, and you have to kind of, you know, work with that. But it's not out of the ballpark. I will tell you something that is really important when you stop and think of silks. A lot of times people say, oh, my wife sews or so-and-so sews. What they don't get is there's a special cut. It's a special cut, and when I say cut, kind of pattern design, it's made for racing. It's not just a shirt pattern.
Yeah, and it's made for hunting over and doing everything they have to do.
Right. And you can tell when the jockey is racing and he's sitting there in homemade silks because they're all blousy and real billowy. They're not cut for a design. Aerodynamic does not only mean the stretch silks, but nylon silks can be very sleek and not fill with air. It's the cut and how they're constructed.
Well, I think
and yes, we can make a triple
Jamie
extra large.
Our co-host Jamie would probably fit in silks. And you know what we should do, Jennifer? We should order a set and get our logo put on and everything and make her use them during cross-country and eventing. She can wear anything you want. I think she'd look really cool. I have to make sure they fit over her vest, though. But thank you so much for being on. It's classicsilksusa.com if you want to check it out. They have a really cool builder where you can actually build the silks, so that's kind of neat. Thank you, Stephanie, for telling us stuff. You know, we see them all the time, but you never think about them much, and now we know more than we ever did.
Right. Okay, well, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Stephanie. Well, now you know everything you ever wanted to know about silks.
And more.
Which, What she basically said is they're not going to fit me. Forget it. They're too small. We don't make them in your size is what she basically said. And if they're $150 to $300 for the little guys, they're going to be $1,000 for me. That's what she was telling us.
They'll just take two, one for the back, one for the front.
That's probably true. Well, thank you so much to everybody for joining us this week. We'll be back on Monday. But before we go, I have to say really quick that Yahoo did an article. It was very funny on the most difficult sports in the Olympics, and they rated all 32 sports. And I'll just give you the top five here real quick because equestrian is on there. They rated all 32 sports, and this is sort of tongue-in-cheek. Number five was sailing. They said this isn't like taking a booze cruise off the coast. Those booms come out of nowhere, so they rated sailing as the number five hardest sport in the Olympics. Canoe and kayaking, basically they said, have you seen those rapids they have to do? And that is true. I don't know how they stay up at all. Water polo, I love this. They dunk you without warning and throw elbows like a basketball player. What goes on underwater stays underwater until it becomes a massive hematoma 48 hours later. That does look like a rough sport. Triathlon, a mile swim on the open water, followed by a 25-mile bike ride and a 6-mile run. No snark. That's a lot of activity. And the number one most difficult sport, judged by this Yahoo article, is equestrian. And they basically just said this, can you ride a horse? Me neither. Love it. Equestrian is the most difficult sport in the Olympics. So keep that in mind as you're watching all of those athletes coming up here in 2 weeks. Thank you, Jennifer, for filling in today. Really appreciate it.
It was fun.
Now, we'll see you all back here on Monday. Don't forget you can listen to all the past episodes on the Horse Radio Network at horseradionetwork.com. And we'll see you. We'll hear Jamie's stories on Monday. Now, say her line. Spay, neuter, and geld, everybody. Have a great weekend. Wear your helmets.